This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are on remote. We have a poet here today, Tom Curlin, and he is the 2019 winner of the National William Meredith Award for Poetry. And Tom is going to give us an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. It's a pleasure to be here, especially on Earth Day. So let's start with a little bit of out-of-this-world experience called Under the Potato Moon, which is the title of the first book I published, or was published for me. As some people know, to grow a potato, you slice it into parts, and the eye turns into a root. Everything appears underground, or disappears underground, and you harvest it. Under the potato moon, I will bury one eye in dirt, tilt a cleft heart to old earthworms, and wiggle a white leg bright with the secrets of birth. Under the potato moon, our desires will rise thick in your side to a rock, until laundry hangs wide from the vine, limp as old sex, moist and forgot. Under the potato moon, a child will rake mud from her eyes and toss back her straw locks, for tonight the gardener times the red heart so ready to rot.
The voice of Tom Curlin. He had me at Potato Moon all those years ago. So tell us who William Meredith was, since you are the holder of his moniker, his name, and what is Enabling Love about, your award-winning book?
Well, this is the cover of the book to give you a sense of it. Enabling
Gorgeous.
Love is a tribute to William Meredith, who was a winner of many awards. I should say a Pulitzer Prize winner, and someone who was a Library of Congress holder for two periods and was an extraordinary teacher of poetry. He is a naval pilot for both the World War II and for the Korean War. But I think most notable is that he set a standard of poetry that is enduring, and I find him someone who is both very formal in his art, but also extraordinarily attentive to the vicissitudes of being mortal, but also very generous in his spirit. And so he has one little poem from the Chinese Banyan called, "There is no end to the deception of quiet things and of quiet everyday people a lifetime brings." So being aware of deception, he then, if you will, sets a standard that he says, he talks about self-reckoning. And he talks about the fact that the edge of the Greek world, there is a the gods send an old sentimental hungry vulture called compassion.
Mm.
To gnaw at the stone vitals of each of us, even the young, as if to ready each of us, even the old, for an unthinkable event he foresees for each of us, a reckoning our own. So to think of compassion, of demanding of us a reckoning.
Mm.
And so in that framework, I then chose a portion of a poem called Enabling Love. And William invokes that in a poem called A Ghost of a House. And he says, "Enabling love, roof of this drafty hutch, take care of the haunts who stay with us here. In little space for a long time while they walked, wakeful when we sleep, averting their sad glance when we clumsy with one another, they look at something we cannot see as yet. They creak the boards beside the bed we creak in some hard durance. And if we're weary at night, what must they be? Bed them with like us at last under your roof. Wishing our sibling spirits nothing but good, let them see these chambers once with daylight eyes you lend to lovers for our mortal time, or change some loveless stalker into me before my bone house rattles into lime." So he asks of us both to enable love, we are the agents of bringing love into the world, but also knowing that love enables us to bring compassion to others and to activate, if you will, a broader, more magnificent world. So he has, to me, the spirit that's essential to what goes into poetry.
and you are much inspired by him. Indeed. He was somewhat of a formalist, I would say. Do you describe yourself as a formalist, narrative, epic, language, lyrical? What kind of poet do you describe yourself as?
I consider myself a lapsed farmer, an iambic fundamentalist, and a reluctant transcendentalist.
Whoa. And I give up. So, then let us hear a poem to prove it, just to prove it.
Okay, here's one called Van Gogh Afield. And this is long after I've moved off the farm into the city. So I'm past the potato moon, that darkness of the night that falls on the Midwestern landscape. And so here I am in the city in an office building called Van Gogh Afield. Old coat clapping in leper age, umbrella buttons dancing in the rain. Whenever I look out locked office windows, I recall hired men gathered half drunk with thunder in my father's empty grain elevators where, like old maids, they proceed to play cards. Between hands, silence beats down on every man until eyes blank stare out across stubbled lands and time blinks only with its lips. About then, the weather vane turns preacher, begins to pray. Archangel rain, trod your sodden way and torch these fields with such crippled grace. Van Gogh himself would lurch a field to paint his breath away. But first, strike down this blackened sky with thunderbolts and needlepoint fresh stalks of hay. Soon, every bright tinkling flash brights and skips across a brazen kiss across the barn's bright blue copper braids, then sets ablaze our pasture gates with such morning glories that man and beast and boy sallies forth from dairy warmth to plant yellow corn and bunch East Maiden's knees. For in these hours, men bend low to tie a sash of cedar posts and pull flecks of thistle down from September's woven gown. For here and there she spreads a groaning board and welcomes crows and cows and beasts to seeded fields where madmen dance and women walk afar, flecked with larks and timothy. And yet I doubt this ever happened or ever could be, for gifts such as these once opened were often set aside or ever seldom seen.
Beautiful, beautiful. I could count your syllables. I could count your syllables. How long does such a poem take to breathe that body into the poem? You're a narrative poet, by the way, lyrical narrative.
Okay, there you go.
We got you down. Okay. And also, you have a secret life. You were smart. And I know because in addition to winning the Larry Neal Poetry Award and the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities, you were a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow to go to postdoctoral Yale. And I know I worked at NEH, and man, that is hard to get that fellowship. Tell me, what was the field you went to study? How did you satisfy NEH by doing that?
Well, I was teaching at Clark College in Dubuque, Iowa. There's one Clark College in upper New England where Freud gave his first lecture, I think, in 1906 or 7. This is a small women's college in Dubuque, Iowa, where I'd started a class in science fiction and fantasy, and then George R. R. Martin took over the Game of Thrones, took over my class, not knowing him at the time, and he didn't know me. Then I went up to Madison and taught some science fiction and fantasy up there in an interdisciplinary class. But in between, I was fortunate enough to go to Yale and study under Harold Bloom, some romantic poetry, and J. Hillis Miller from Hopkins, Johns Hopkins. So I took two classes that summer. And so I was most fortunate to do that. So
that's
the experience.
But you are a scientist, because I know that your career has been in energy, and on the federal level, you have worked with ecology and all kinds of things. So what is your doctorate in?
It's in British Lit and Romantic. Well, it's basically from Shakespeare forward to the World War II in British Lit. And then I have an ability to understand vocabulary and then decision making. And then I'll say, translate that into language, which people can understand in a more common setting or
Literature trained you to help the politicians do the right thing. But right now, you're our poet. So I would like two poems in a row.
Okay. All right. Let's do a postcard from Panavecchio. This was from a trip that was part of the honeymoon. The walking moon rests just ahead on the vegetable grower's pockmarked neck. Here sits another ledge crossing the Arno where I once feared to crawl out onto. But yesterday, smelling bread, you left me abridged. No words to address the foul bottom-feeding fish, the one-eyes, your figs and fresh fruit flies, until, cauliflower in hand, exuding, as always, regret, I read from some distance the fine print on your bougainvillea dress, which said, most days love wanders on ahead, like this, being Odyssean, you know, and unread. But eventually, what starts out as adventure gets tossed aside instead into laundry baskets, salads, lunch meat, stuffed chairs, and unmade beds. Occasionally, too, I fall sideways behind your bureau, where you lapse into doubt, which slips into dread, and so we keep ourselves inside ourselves, fearing the simplest of heartbeats high, which makes all the difference between being loved, unloved, irrelevant, unfaithful, or dead. About now, the vegetable grower fairly barked at me, so forget Calypso, she's in your head. To her, you're just another pig underfoot, plus you owe twice last month's rent. He turned away, muttering something like, just find her. Which is why, fragile and rare as a postcard unread, I arrive tonight in your bed, in Bellagio, Italia, in your arms, addressed, expressed.
Tom Curlin wrote poetry on his honeymoon.
I waited until I got home.
Bellagio, though, not a bad scene.
No, it's beautiful, beautiful.
Wow.
So here's coming home and then enjoying the time with Catherine, with friends. Bones laid bare to teeth again. The flesh hard salted to small, unswallowed wishes for sons and one more daughter. The wishbone, wine-soaked, broken now. You holding one, I the other. A coffee filter, the spill of table linens, and guests gone home to fold themselves to bed in useless prayer. Their empty dishes up at you can only stare, as for hours after the dinner watch, we ladle the sweet sauce of looks and talk across ripe, uneaten pear. How the candle body sings. Feast and appetite, what but the love of bones ever set our table right?
What do you think poetry does, Tom?
It keeps us standing upright. It helps us walk through the most difficult places we'll ever see or never see. And it helps us through places where I'd like to take you next, which is a basketball court where I played ball any number of times and got to know some of the people in a neighborhood here in Northeast D.C. It's a eulogy for a fellow named James, and it's called James is Dead. Your wet heart skipped at 3 p.m. as concrete shook the last dark leaf on Jackson Street. So this way, perhaps, the blow that missed would not matter, as you did to us, lying minutes away, fixing a last glimpse on Lady Lovely. The brain cleared briefly, you smiled, and for once we all fit in it, a single whisper, like cries to dinner, drifting up the street. Dark James, it rushed, is dying. James is dying. James, they took him sleeping. James, he wore no sheet. Dark James on table is dying. James, he be with me see him walking, even we hear weeping. When suddenly your eyes rolled white off two overhand rights, up an alley of summer trees, like two fixed candles bleeding in asphalt eternity. The golden nose, quantum, easy street, 200 below the Iceman. You rode those names for 19 years in one stiff breeze across our playground in Donald's Grand Marquis. Yes, I know they held the ragman back. Yes, I know you shouted names for $15 owed and reached out, rocking like a surgeon in designer jeans to punch his lights out. But the lady scratched you back. We screamed. It was all so polite and easy. Bright smile on bright smile, tumbling that day on darker truss toward us, oh sharp, concussive James. Oh James, these men of tears and gathered blood. Chris, Bo, Larry, David, this wailing fuss of daughters dazed in halter tops and unborn sons. Your mother's buried love, all could risk the sudden rush of rising up. Your death unearthed the air in us. That's what poetry does.
Asphalt eternity. Asphalt eternity. Do you think that your lyricism comes from the vowels? As I listen to it, the melody seemed to be riding the vowels. I know you're not conscious of that when you write it, but could that be possible?
It is. I think if I remember correctly, in our first reading, you said something to the effect of your long vowels excite me, Grace.
Oh, that's it. You're the vowel man. I've been looking for you my whole life. I met a vowel man who turned me on so much, and his consonants aren't bad either. And we're back together again. See, you got it going on. You didn't lose it. You didn't lose it, Tom. Let's hear another poem.
Okay. Let's try one that's published more recently called Radishes.
Oh, yes. I would like you to take that apart for us. And we want to dissect your brain and find out how you tick. It might be hard, but we want to know how you thought of this after you read it.
Sure.
What you thought of, how you got the idea, how you started, what you had to overcome. Analyze it.
All right, certainly. Gardening at dusk, a pen light salts your tongue as we turn dirt, pulling dandelion roots and tubers from spinning earth, plus one fat mossy clump of salad greens snatched from the Arctic front will welcome within a week. Now more than ever, your sideways glances remind me we once weeded ground cherries here, at this very spot, husks and verbs of yesteryear, small hand-blown domes seeded by summer light, saffron globes a simple child holds up to light to stare through, as we so often do. Soon, we too will be pulled from translucent earth by roots thin and gray and planted somewhere to rot, seeding all fruitful thought. That's why I grow more crisp than bitter, You more saucy than hot. So, first of all, it's a song. It's a sonnet. So it sort of sneaks its way into that framework. And it started because I do like gardening, as does my wife. And it grows out of a lifetime of that experience and of going all the way back to from Potato Moon through the dining there and the banquet to this experience being beside another body of someone you love, clearly. And so there's a comfort to it. There's weather around it. There's an earthiness to it. There's a realization that we do rot from the potato to the person. So the language to me is a natural, it's not just nature, it's a natural idiom for how I feel and how I process. So it goes from a feeling to a thought to a word is the way poetry is described.
It's a good way to describe it, yeah.
Good way to describe it. It's certainly not, I'm not original in that regard. But the idea anyway is that is you find your way to the word. And I probably have written this poem at least 45 to 60 times to get to this level of, and I'm still fiddling with a's and the's and it's and that's. I mean, it's just one of those poems where I can't let go of it.
Wow.
So that's
find your way to the word. Find your way to the word.
You can't.
But you know, diction, the word choices are all in keeping with the theme so beautifully. It's a good example because they're all very natural, accessible words that come from the earth. They demonstrate what you're talking about. So the word choice and the diction really make that a very complete poem. Mm-hmm. Most people try to get something across with the wrong words.
Right. They're not fancy words. They're pretty straightforward. Some are cliches even. I mean, there's a way to, but I mean, they do sort of, some sneak up on you and surprise you as you go around the end of the line, and they try to, you know, seeding. There's C-E-D-E as opposed to S-E-E-D. I mean, there are ways in which you're trying to surprise people as they go around the corner.
Surprise, that's a good word to use.
That's part of the way you sneak up. And you know, you're more saucy than hot. You're trying to twist it in a way that you delight your partner as well as your reader. And there's ways you're speaking to the person in the poem as well as out to the reader. So you're drawing everyone into the universe. So those are things that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to delight my partner in crime as well as my reader who I'm inviting into the universe that I'm creating here. And it's a very small, tight world. And I realize in one sense, it's not a very large world. On the other hand, it's a very immortal world. It's one very mortal and immortal world. So I'm trying to make it as fine in a sense of elaborate, deep world, not a dark world, but a deep world that takes on a dark subject.
Do you think that's why poetry makes us less lonely? Because you are saying things that other people just think, and that you're including the reader and summoning the reader in so that it's not, you're not just sitting on Mount Olympus, you know, declaring things. So what is it that makes us less lonely?
What oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed was the way Goldsmith described, this is 18th century, good writing. I mean, he's talking about an essayist. He says, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed. I mean, that is a familiar essay. He's describing one of his fellow essayists. But that is really what, and that's sort of, I'll call it good writing, not extraordinary. This is not Paradise Lost. We're talking about just good writing. That's what that is. But I think really the transcendent kind of writing that really truly moves us, that makes the hair stand up on the back of our neck, is something that draws us in a ways that just does not let us go, because it is moving, given the stakes that we see the person enduring. And we associate with, because it's life and death, or it's something much larger than we that we associate with.
But it includes us.
Oh, yes.
That's the big thing.
Right.
Poetry that includes is the one that will last, I think.
Right. Right.
And so let's hear one more.
All right. Let me offer you Amish, another sonnet. Over these hills, the Amish have settled like a sonnet, lending sparse order to grief, trotting ever so faintly along sharp borders, hooves rhyming slight figures to speech. Even in midwinter, mortal smells like animals scatter fresh straw at its feet, until morning's red legs, fence, steam in rough stalls, heat rising from dung heaps. God, forgive us who drive among them to be gone, scattered by muscular cars. We crows lift our black arms, silent in homage, crying no obituary.
Muscular, what is the word after muscular?
Cars.
Cars, muscular cars. That is the one that had me, I stopped in my tracks.
So we're crows, suddenly we're the Amish and buggies, and then suddenly we're crows and we're scattered by muscular cars, and our cries are not obituaries. I mean, you know, this to me is one of the things that sort of, I mean, when I got to that and I wrote that down, I said, oh, wow, you know, I'm with the crows. I go, you know, I can't linger on this scene, and I will not cry an obituary. This is a sonnet, that cry.
I love crows.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah, but, who wouldn't? But what is a sonnet?
What is a sonnet?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are several kinds, but, you know, it's the 14 line, usually the quatrains and then the couplet at the end. But you want to turn that corner. I mean, the Germans have what's called a Wendepunkt in the short story, which is that turning point. Or, I see ghosts, or I see dead people. It's that sense at the very end that makes you realize that you've been talking to a ghost the entire film or the short story, and that's a modern version of that old notion.
So the Italians called volta.
Yeah.
So you've got 14 lines
right. In
couplets, right?
Yes.
And where do they rhyme?
Right.
Where do they rhyme? At the end of each line? We're just trying to teach everybody everything you know.
Yes.
And then if there's a turn, which a point of view turns someplace.
Right. Usually toward the middle. Sometimes you can save it to the end. You can save mm-hmm. it to the last.
And do you do that faithfully for every sonnet? Because I've seen sonnets without volta, without that shift. Shakespeare doesn't always have.
No, he does not always. I mean, again, there's quite a bit of fluidity, and people now are doing very interesting things with poetry that are hybrid, and of course prose mm-hmm. poems. I mean, there are any number of ways where poetry is melding back and forth mm-hmm. with prose and mm-hmm. even journalism. I mean, it's really becoming quite fluid.
It's because it's a living thing.
It is indeed.
A living thing. And so are we. And so let us have a final poem. Tom Curlin.
Okay. Let me see if I can find something that gets us off the page here. Come, spark, cut down the dark, and in its narrow stead do nominate the heart. Brighten every living part. Lift up your bell this weathered sky above the bay, and anvil out sweet mercy on our day. Assuage the surly wind and stir again your marble foot above the midnight air. Select one candle there, your feet wrapped in cinnamon despair, and step out upon earth's spiral spinning stair. And swirl in your mortal youth your glory there. O loose your radiant morning hair. Spill out the larks, we pray.
The voice of Thomas Curlin. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, with support from the Sinipet Fund and Avide Shoshani. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.